Before we get into today's show, I have an urgent update to share with you. As you probably know, this podcast is made possible by the generous support of listeners like you. And with our financial year ending on June 30th, we're facing a $52,000 gap in funding that must be closed by this date. With just days to go, generous friends of the ministry have now offered to match every dollar given towards this goal up to $10,000. So please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for joining us on the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And do register there for a chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. And if you are on Instagram or TikTok, please do check us out at Premier Unbelievable. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, then please do consider rating and reviewing it on your podcast platform so that more people can hear about it. But now for today's show. In this episode, we're going to be hearing something a little bit different from normal. In November 2022, Ulster University hosted the first international academic C.S. Lewis symposium to be held in Northern Ireland. The event, called Now We Have Faces, was hosted by the C.S. Lewis group at Ulster University in coordination with English at Ulster, and they very kindly let us broadcast the talks on this podcast. The presentation you are about to hear is by Reverend Dr. Malcolm Guite, a poet, priest and scholar who is supernumerary fellow at Girton College, Cambridge. The title of Malcolm's keynote address was A Little Incarnation, C.S. Lewis and the Poetry of Embodiment. What you are about to hear is the first part of his talk.
It's really good to be here. It's good to be in a whole, and as we've heard, you know, scandalously neglected bit of Lewis country, a really significant piece of terrain. I'm going to talk in a minute about Shakespeare's dictum that poetry has to take what might otherwise float away airily and give it a local habitation and a name. And I think we're redressing an imbalance in coming back to a really important local habitation of Lewis, and therefore a significant part of who he is. So one of the themes of this day is embodiment, and that's the theme I want to pick up on. It was beautifully picked up on by both our speakers earlier on. I loved that reflection on reading Out of the Silent Planet in a sort of post-pandemic moment, and the urgency of actual encounter as well as its challenges. And of course, that lovely thing on the neglected Irishness and austeriority of Lewis. So I want to start with a place in Lewis where he uses the phrase giving body. And it's a late book of Lewis's. It's in Reflections on the Psalms, which, let's be specific and particular, this is what it looked like when it came out as the first edition. It came out in 58. So it's quite a late work of Lewis's. It's a mature reflection. And in the introduction to that book, he says something very instructive about the Psalms, but in the end about poetry. He says that the Psalms are emphatically poetry, that they have to be read as poetry, with all the license on the one hand and all the formality on the other of what poetry is. And he goes on to talk about the beautiful poetic technique of parallelism in the Psalms, which he brilliantly describes. You know, I mean, it's parallelism is where you say one thing in one set of terms, then you repeat it in a variation of terms that reflects back on the first, O Lord, open thou our lips, and our mouth shall proclaim thy praise, that kind of thing. And he talks about how that, he calls it thought rhyme. He says, whereas the rhyme scheme of a poem, which is a rhyme scheme in sound, is, strictly speaking, impossible to translate. But perhaps it was a divine providence that this extraordinary book of poems, which would be lying there at the heart of Scripture, were written in a poetic form, which is perhaps the most translatable of all poetic forms. He then goes on to discuss how Christ's own utterances sometimes took on and reflected the parallelism, the poetic technique of the Psalms. So he gives us an example. He says, our Lord was soaked in the poetic tradition of his country. He delighted to use it. And then he quotes, for with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged, and with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. Lewis comments, the second half of the verse makes no logical addition. It echoes with variation the first. Another example, ask and it shall be given you, seek and ye shall find, knock and it shall be opened unto you. The variation is a variation proper to poetry. And then comes the passage I've given you as the first thing here. And this is on the idea that Jesus was uttering carefully formed poetry in the poetical form of his own local tradition, the Psalms. And there are two sentences in this little passage. One is really quite complex and has a very balanced parenthetical phrase in the middle of it. You've really got to stretch your grammar a bit to get to it. And then it's followed by a really short, punchy sentence, which utterly sums it up. And that's very much in Lewis's style. So let's just take a little look at what he says. It's a very strange, it's almost a kind of circumspection around. It's a kind of delicate finding of names for the unnameable. Here's what he says. It seems to me appropriate, almost inevitable, that when that great imagination, which in the beginning, for its own delight and for the delight of men and angels and in their proper mode of beasts, had invented and formed the whole world of nature, submitted to express itself in human speech, that speech should sometimes be poetry. Now, he could have made that a little simpler, but there's a kind of something deliberate, something almost, there's a kind of aspect of proper respect to the mystery of God. He doesn't say, well, I think it's a good thing that when God made the world for the delight of all its inhabitants and then submitted to become a part of his world, that he should use this particular form of poetry. But it doesn't call him God, does he? He says, when that great imagination... Now, this is progress for Lewis. If you look at the early Lewis and his fears and suspicions of his own imagination and the long, great war he had with Owen Barfield about whether or not the imagination could bear truth, see how far he's travelled that just a few years before his death, he is happy to call God, and I think specifically God the Son, the Logos, the one in whom and through whom everything was made. Well knowing, of course, because he has his New Testament Greek, that the word for made in that preface to John's Gospel is poiein. That's why the Scots are right to call poets makers, makers. When in the beginning... was the word was with God, the word was God. There was no poetry without him, would be another way of saying. The world was made as a poem in him and through him. He knows what that word made. So now he's gone so far as to call the Logos, in whom all things were made in the beginning, he uses the phrase both from Genesis and John. He's prepared to call him that great imagination. That's an astonishing thing. He gets there through Coleridge and others, as I hope to show. But he calls God that great imagination, which in the beginning, for its own delight and for the delight of men and angels, and then he can't help putting in, and in their proper mode of beasts. He's very inclusive here. I know men isn't inclusive language now, but he clearly intends to include the whole of humanity. But he wants to include more than the whole of humanity. He wants to include those angelic intelligences of which we hear some whisper and rumour, but whose form we could never entirely comprehend because of it's another order for ours, though in his description of the elders, he went a long way towards that. You've got several modes of being. You've got men, humanity in the middle, and the creation is for all of them and is intended both that God should delight in them and that they should delight in God. But the mode of God's godness in which that delight happens, for Lewis here, is the imagination. That great imagination had invented and formed the whole world of nature. that great imagination, we've still got to keep the word submitted, very careful choice of the word submitted. There's an echo there, surely. There's a whole theology of kenosis, that though he was found in form equal to God, he did not cling to equality with God, but emptied himself, taking the form of a servant. That God comes in and obeys his own rules and conforms to the world which he himself formed, and learns to speak a particular language and has a local habitation and a particular place. That when that great imagination enters the world and submits to express itself in human speech, so the acquisition of language is a kind of paradoxical submission. We submit to the language and the way language is formed, but then the way language is formed empowers and enables us. There's a sense in which, for the poet, the service of language is also a kind of perfect freedom. It's a very important word there, submit. When that great imagination that made nature submitted to express itself in human speech, that speech should sometimes be poetry. And then, as we're sort of gasping and trying to find our way grammatically through that highly complex sentence, he sums it up, he embodies it in a much more particular way in the second sentence. For poetry, too, is a little incarnation, giving body to what has been fought before, been invisible and inaudible. I want, in the time that I've got, to do two things. I want to unpack particularly that second little sentence. Poetry too is a little incarnation, giving body to what had before been invisible and inaudible. And then I want to talk a little bit about how Lewis got to this glorious affirmation of the imagination and of poetry as absolutely proper to God the Word, and in the mouth of God the Word made flesh in Jesus. How he got there.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that this podcast is made possible by the generosity of friends like you. And right now, we're facing a $52,000 funding gap that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June 30th. Generous friends of this ministry have offered to match every dollar given up to $10,000. So I'm asking you to give your very best gift right now. Your gift will help keep important conversations like this one coming to listeners like you. Closing this gap in full by June 30th is vital. So please give your best gift today, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/CS Lewis. Thank you.
The CS Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation.
So let's start with just unpacking this idea of poetry is a little incarnation, giving body to what had been before invisible and inaudible. I think Lewis is echoing, I think consciously, possibly unconsciously, Lewis. I'm glad we've got someone writing on Lewis and Shakespeare, because, Lewis absorbed Shakespeare so deeply that it was, you know, part of his very thought patterning. But I think the allusion here to the famous passage about poetry in A Midsummer Night's Dream is conscious, because of the giving body and the invisible. I'm just giving you here, in the next extract, the core of it. The poet's eye, in fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. And as imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. You can see immediately the language of body. You can see how the airy nothing, the thing you couldn't quite get hold of, has now been given visible and audible form. And those beautiful words that every artist loves, bodies, form, shape. It's an astonishing passage about poetry. And for a long time, when I read it and loved it, I always thought it was only about poetry. And insofar as it was only about poetry, it was brilliant. Shakespeare's account of it there. Brilliant, particularly in that moment where Shakespeare unexpectedly juxtaposes the two words imagination and bodies. I mean, if we were to do, I would never do this, but if I was to do that slightly awkward thing that speakers sometimes do, where you divide the audience and tell them off and everybody has to go into little buzz groups and then report back. Fear not, I'm not going to do this. But if I were to do that, and I said, well, over here, I want you people to be word brainstorming and word associating with the word imagination. And over here, I want you people to be, you know, brainstorming and word associating about bodies. My guess is that we would get clusters of words and associations from two completely different registers. That the imagination people, it would all be a bit spiritual and thin and diaphanous, and there might be a few sort of glowing unicorns and fine rainbows, but it would all be a little bit shimmery and unrooted. And depending on your mood and feeling of the day, the bodies people, it would all either all be glorious sculpted bodies and rippling muscles and, you know, delicious curves, or it would be all about aching joints and blood and sweat and you know, the dankness of cold clothes in the morning. Or whatever. But we wouldn't find much of a meeting place. We would somehow assume that the imagination and the imaginative was disembodied. Not so, says Shakespeare. The whole purpose of the imagination, he says, is to take something which we would otherwise have not comprehended or got hold of and give it a body, give it a bodily form. You may remember that earlier on in that speech, just before this passage and a little later on, just after this passage, Shakespeare carefully pairs two words which are about different ways of knowing. That is to say, apprehend and comprehend. You remember earlier on, he says that imagination apprehends more than cool reason ever comprehends. And then after this passage, he says, if it would but apprehend some joy, it comprehends some bringer of that joy. Now, apprehend and comprehend are paired on a kind of polar, Coleridge would call a polar logic. There's a sense in which we see them as at opposite ends of ways of knowing. You know the sense. Obviously, the prehend bit of apprehend and comprehend in Latin is about getting hold of something. So, you know, there are some monkeys that have prehensile tails. They can actually pick things up with them, which is would be really useful. But if you apprehend, you reach out and can just about touch a bit of it. If you comprehend, you understand it comprehensively, you can get your mind all around it. Something is going on in Shakespeare between apprehend and comprehend, imagination and body, and also heaven and earth, earth and heaven. The point about the poet, Shakespeare is saying, is that the poet's eye, in fine frenzy rolling, doth glance from heaven to earth, from earth to heaven. We have two trajectories. How do we ever connect them? Heaven, the apprehended, the invisible, the inaudible, if you like, as he would put it here, and earth, the comprehended, the visible, the known. But earth without heaven is just a dull clod. But heaven without earth is inapprehensible, incomprehensible. You know, as you say, if you ever get around, if you get around to reading the Athanasian Creed ever, it'll say, the whole thing, totally incomprehensible. And yet heaven chooses in Christ to be bodied forth. Now, when I thought this was just about poetry, this passage from Shakespeare, I found it helpful. I particularly found it helpful to think of the two trajectories. On the one hand, the glance from heaven to earth, and on the other hand, the glance from earth to heaven. And I felt it was a very helpful way of looking about how poets and artists work. It doesn't matter which end you start, the point is to connect them. So you can have, just to take two 20th century and, in Kehini's case, 21st century examples, if you take a poet like Eliot has this great power of abstraction. He's a highly intellectual man. He's written, you know, this dissertation, this PhD on F.H. Bradley, you know, and transcendental idealism and all of that. but he's a poet. And he starts with the heavenly, with the apprehension, with something that we might never get hold of at all. And then he works hard to bring it down to earth and to find one image after another to body it forth. You can see it in the early Eliot, can't you say, where he says, literally, I must borrow every changing shape to find expression, dance like a dancing bear, chatter like an ape. Or where he says so brilliantly in Prufrock, a wonderful image, he says, I should have been a pair of silent claws. I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across the floors of silent seas. He's really embodied a certain feeling of weirdness and alienation, and, you know, it's brilliant. He starts with the heavenly, and he looks out. And, of course, in his mature poetry, in the Four Quartets, you see it even more. He actually breaks into his own poetry, doesn't he? He gives you a beautiful passage of poetry, and then he says, well, that was a way of putting it, you know, an unsatisfactory way of putting it. And he talks about his poetic effort as a series of raids on the inarticulate with shabby equipment, always deteriorating in the general mass of imprecision of feeling. So he starts at the heavenly, but he's successful as a poet because he does, in fact, body forth in a series of images which communicate long before they're understood. Eliot is always quoted as saying that poetry needs to be difficult, which led, I think, some of his followers to the unfortunate conclusion that if it's difficult, it must be poetry, which is not the case. But he also said true poetry communicates before it's understood, and it communicates because the images are so real and so compelling and are able to body forth again and again a series of things that otherwise would have been only apprehended. Eliot also famously said that poetry is peripheral vision, that you see it, but if you turn to look at it, it's gone. But if you remain still enough, you can woo the peripheral vision in to the centre. So I used to think, well, that's a good account of poetry from Shakespeare here. It works for Eliot, heaven to earth.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. We were hearing there from the Reverend Dr. Malcolm Guite. He gave that presentation at a C.S. Lewis symposium called Now We Have Faces. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And do register there for the chance to win a free book. That's premierunbelievable.com. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating it and reviewing it on your podcast platform. Thank you for listening and see you next time.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.